the only governor in American history who was ever elected and re-elected during his first term. Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, who last year defeated a recall effort on Uncommon Knowledge from Washington, D.C., now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, now on the website of the Wall Street Journal. In his 2010 campaign for governor of Wisconsin, Republican Scott Walker defeated Democrat Tom Barrett with 52% of the vote. Obtaining roughly a million signatures, Governor Walker's opponents forced him into a recall election last year. Running once again against Democrat Tom Barrett, Governor Walker won this time with 53% of the vote, becoming the first governor in all of American history to survive a recall. Scott Walker spent much of his boyhood in Devlin, Wisconsin, where he became an Eagle Scout. Before becoming governor, he served for just under a decade in the Wisconsin State Assembly and then for 8 years as Milwaukee County Executive. Governor Walker, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Segment one, Obamacare in the Badger State. You've made two big decisions about the way Obamacare will function in Wisconsin. We'll come in a moment to the decision that has made news in February 2013. First, the decision you made late last year, the insurance marketplaces or exchanges that Obamacare mandates, whereas a lot of states, including Ohio under your fellow Republican John Kasich, have chosen to create exchange partnerships with the federal government, you decided to reject the exchange provision altogether, requiring the feds to create an exchange in Wisconsin by itself. How come?
Simple. When I looked, and I spent nearly 2 years looking at this, here we are in Washington, just a few paces away from our nation's White House. I visited as a new governor in December 2010. As part of that visit, I met with Secretary Sebelius, the head of the Federal Department of HHS, and have spent the last 2 years with my team, my administration, my cabinet, working with the federal government, trying to fully understand and comprehend what it meant to my state and other states. And it was clear. It's a C-no. State name only. This really isn't an exchange that the states run or even run in a partnership. The federal government determines what's going to be covered, how it's going to be covered. And the only distinction is whether or not a state can say that they're running it, put up a sign that says they're running it. But in the end, there's no real substantive difference between a federal exchange or a state exchange or the in-between, the hybrid, the partnership. And so I said, if I can't run it, if I really don't have control over it, why would I take the responsibility of explaining to people something that I don't have any control over? Now, that is at odds with my gut instincts, which is I think any time you have a chance between the state running something or the federal government running something, we're always much better having the states run it. But in this case, when it's really state name only, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay. The second big decision. Obamacare requires states to extend Medicaid to those earning up to 133% of the federal poverty level, or lose federal funding. Early this year, you said nothing doing to the Medicaid expansion, but announced that Wisconsin would extend health insurance to nearly the same number of people by giving them access to the new insurance exchanges. Mm-hmm. Explain that one.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's, again, one of those where we didn't do a knee-jerk reaction. We really looked at the nuances, knew that every state's a little bit different. My predecessor, under a program called Badger Care, Jim Doyle, a Democrat governor before I was in office, had lifted the amount of coverage under Badger Care up to 200%. But then, as often is the case, because the state didn't have enough money, he then capped it off. So today, there are some 82,000 people living in poverty who are not eligible, who are, or I should say, are eligible, but not covered under Badger Care because there's not enough money. So what we did is we looked at our scenario and said, we can create a system that doesn't take the federal money, that doesn't put us on the hook, and I mean that because I think the federal government can't cover costs to continue for Medicaid in Wisconsin today, let alone an expansion. Mm-hmm. And Lord knows when they have a $16.5 trillion debt, it seems highly unlikely that they're going to be able to cover those costs in the future. But in our case, saying we're not going to take the expansion, we're not going to expose our taxpayers to future exposure in terms of higher costs that we'll have to pick up, just under the law itself, in 3 years when it goes from 100% to 90%, and conceivably even greater exposure if the federal government reneges on all our portions of that.
You've called it a baby, the gift of a baby elephant.
Well, exactly right. I mean, it just keeps growing and growing, and we don't have the capacity to cover it. Now, what we do, though, is we have 224,000 plus people today who are uninsured, will no longer be uninsured. They move into the marketplace, either through traditional health insurance or through the exchanges. Whether I agree or disagree with it, the exchanges are there in the federal government.
Right.
And at the same time, I reduce the net number of people on Medicaid. I take 87,000 people living above poverty and move them into the marketplace as well. And then in place of that, move a lesser number, 82,000, into Medicaid who are living in poverty, because I think for most of us, we look at Medicaid and say, isn't that what it was intended for?
Right.
To cover people who are in poverty.
Sai Mukherjee on the website Think Progress, quote, Walker's proposal is a raw deal because it will restrict the number of specialty medical services that poor Wisconsinites have access to. That's because Medicaid provides a range of benefits that lower-tier health plans, which are the only kind that poor Americans will be able to afford under Walker's plan, don't cover.
Well, it's an interesting concept for some of the very same people who said the exchanges in the Affordable Care Act was a wonderful thing, because they're kind of fighting out of both sides of their mouth. They're saying, well, this doesn't work under our scenario, but they said the exchanges were a wonderful thing. All we're doing is providing access to exchanges with a subsidy for which a low-income single individual moving just above, who's just above poverty, moving out of Medicaid into the marketplace, will be eligible for a plan as little as $19 a month. And to me, if that's an indictment, it's not an indictment of what I'm offering. It's an indictment of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. So on net, Governor Walker's plan for Wisconsin gets uninsured poor people into Medicaid, and instead of expanding Medicaid dramatically, takes people who under, in many states, will be covered by Medicaid and puts them into private health care insurances using the exchanges.
Right. And the key to remember in all this is, you know, you talk about the percentages. The most important thing to remember is Medicaid was designed, at least initially in concept, was supposed to be for covering poor people.
Right.
We cover everyone in our state going forward who's living in poverty will be covered under Medicaid. For those living above Medicaid, we transition them into the marketplace, not just because it's another offering and not just because it provides financial savings to me, which it does because the state doesn't pick up any of the subsidies, but because long term, my goal here in food stamps and unemployment comp is to move people from government dependence to true independence. And the only way you do that is get people off the government dole and instead empower them to control their own lives and their own destiny.
Two more quotations while we're on Obamacare. David Firestone, writing last week in the New York Times, quote, conservatives ridiculed Governor Rick Scott of Florida as a traitor to their cause after he announced that he would expand the state's Medicaid program, exactly what you've chosen not to do, with money from President Obama's health care reform system. In fact, Governor Scott simply accepted reality before they did. He's ahead of you, you're lagging. Eventually, all the holdout states will knuckle under and do exactly the same thing.
Well, that's what the administration, that's what the advocates administration are hoping for. They want a legacy of the Affordable Care Act. They recognize if states don't sign up and run exchanges and if states don't take the Medicaid expansion, that puts a big hole in their legacy here. And they, what they want is not success in the Affordable Care Act. They want more people to be permanently dependent in the government.
So as a working, you're a working practical politician, you've set up this system. Do you feel pressure either politically at home or financial pressure, budget pressure, to knuckle under?
No. I mean, for us,
what you've done is sustainable.
Well, and not only is it sustainable, but it costs less, slightly less, under my scenario than what I have currently. But the challenge is, what they're hoping is that people will bet on the come that there'll be more money in the future. Again, here we sit in Washington, a city that just a month ago was talking about the fiscal cliff driving us into obsolescence. We've now got days from now, March 1st, the sequester coming, and yet again they've kicked the can down. You've got more discussions about pushing things off further into the future. Here we sit with a $16.5 trillion debt. It's one of the things that for my children, someday my grandchildren, are just not conceivably possible of sustaining. And they're worried about adding more money to that. It just seems remarkably out of touch.
Uncle Sam says to Governor Walker, trust me, we'll pick up the tab, and you say, yeah.
Well, and I think just one more example,
sure,
because I know it sounds a little wonkish, but today, forget about the expansion. Just to cover the cost to continue Medicaid in Wisconsin today, it cost me $644 million more. Of that $644 million, 39% of that is attributable to changes made by the federal government and the Affordable Care Act and other related measures that reduced their commitment to covering Medicaid today. If they can't cover what they have in terms of obligating themselves to today, what in God's name makes us think that some point in the future, when this much larger cost kicks in, the federal government's going to have the means to cover that?
Last quotation on Obamacare. Avik Roy in Forbes. Many conservatives still hope that Obamacare can be repealed, but the chances of that are close to zero. Here's the silver lining. Obamacare's exchanges, which you've just been discussing, while seriously flawed, are reformable in a way that Medicaid is not. The exchanges could someday be expanded to provide coverage for people who are today on Medicare and Medicaid, resulting in true long-term entitlement reform. Mm-hmm. Scott Walker's plan is a small step toward that goal, close quote. So you've told us what you've done with Obamacare coming at you, how you intend to handle it. Have you indeed begun thinking long-term thoughts next year, the year after, a few years into the future, about genuine reform?
Oh, there's no doubt in our mind. In fact, a major portion of my overall budget, not only with Medicaid, but with food stamps, with unemployment comp, what we've tried to do is take a step back, and instead of getting engrossed in the nuances and the acronyms here in our nation's capital, is instead focus on what does this mean to real people? What does this mean to our state? What does this mean to us long term? My goal is to move people from government dependence, whether it's on Medicaid, whether it's on food stamps, whether it's unemployment compensation, and find a way to transition them into a way where they get into the private sector, which is a private sector job, a market-driven plan, other things like that, so that ultimately they control their own destiny. Even in this case where and I think it's right in that last quote, there's still some dependence or some involvement in the government in terms of the subsidy provided for the exchange, but we go from a full-out subsidy of Medicaid to one where at least in exchange, if I move people off of Medicaid into the exchanges, there's a transition for them as their income grows, which hopefully under a thriving economy in the future will happen.
All right, segment two, the big fight. Soon after taking office in 2011, you proposed measures to reform the pensions and collective bargaining practices of public employee unions, including the teachers union. Pandemonium breaks out. Protesters occupy the Capitol. President Obama calls your proposals, quote, an assault on unions. Your opponents collect a million signatures. You're forced into a recall election. You won yours, but several Republican members of the Senate did lose. When you took office, the state faced a $3 billion deficit. As I say, pandemonium took place. Let's just quickly go through the results of that big fight, the budget.
We went from over a $3 billion deficit to the budget I announced last week. We had nearly a $500 million surplus, and we were able to invest that in tax cuts, giving that money right back to the people of Wisconsin to further stimulate the economy. That happened because not only the state budget was balanced, but because we empowered local governments, school boards, town boards, city councils, and others to have the tools through collective bargaining reform so they could manage the changes in their budgets as well.
The public employee unions, part of your reforms, the state is no longer deducting union dues from all paychecks. So, have you decisively changed the role of public employee unions in the state?
Absolutely.
Give me the
couple
state
of examples. One, for public employees, and there are a lot of great public servants in our state at the state and the local level, now they have the right to choose. They have the freedom to choose whether or not they want to be in a public employees union or not. They have the right to work and decide what they want to do or not. And so for a teacher in Milwaukee, when that contract's up, they can choose whether or not they want to spend roughly $1,400 in state and local dues or whether they want to spend that money on their kids' education in college someday, or they want to use it to pay for part of their pension or health care contributions. They get to choose. The other benefit is it empowered both our state government, but particularly our local governments, now can hire and fire based on merit. They can pay based on performance. That means we can put our best and our brightest in our classrooms and other positions and pay them to stay there.
Wisconsin politics. Last June, you won your recall election by 7%. Mm-hmm. In fact, your vote went up about 1% from the time you were first elected. And then in November, President Obama carried Wisconsin by 7%. Mm-hmm. So the question is, for conservatives, for everybody, every political observer in the country looks at Scott Walker and says, woo, he won a big fight. Or did he? What's the state of play in Wisconsin politics?
Well, the interesting thing is on the issues we've articulated, both the big one I had in June, and then we had wins in Wisconsin, not in the presidential ballot, not in the U.S. Senate, but we picked up two seats in the state Senate and now have a majority there. We went and added an additional seat in the state assembly where everybody said we'd be lucky if we kept the majority, and even by losing a few seats, we actually went up to 60 out of 99. On the issues where the voters heard what I and other Republicans said about how we were reforming the state, how we were tackling our fiscal and economic challenges, we keep winning in 2012, in my election and in the fall election. I think what it says and the message I've told Republicans and conservatives around the country is we need to be optimistic, we need to be relevant, and we need to be courageous. And unfortunately, we haven't heard that from a lot of our national leaders. We hear it from our governors. That's why not just in Wisconsin, but you look nationally, for the first time in a dozen years, there are 30 states with Republican governors, and nearly half of all the states in America have Republican legislatures. Why? Because as governors and leaders in our states, we're offering optimistic, relevant solutions, and we're showing we have the courage to act on.
Segment three, education. You've mentioned the effect of your reforms on teachers' unions. Let's talk a little bit about Wisconsin schools themselves. You've announced the outlines. By now, I think you just announced your next two-year budget.
Yep,
just last week. Just the other day. All right, so my research may be 48 hours behind you on this one. But as I understand, you're expanding the Wisconsin School Voucher Program.
We are indeed.
Quite a large expansion. Now, correct me, but as best I can tell, as matters stand now, there are voucher programs. These are programs that permit students to use state funds to attend private and religious schools. Voucher programs exist only in Milwaukee and Racine right
now.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. You intend to extend voucher programs to 9 new districts, including Madison. What are you up to? I mean, the obvious question for an outsider is, if it works, why don't you extend it to the whole state? How are things working
here? Yeah, no, that's a great question. What we've done, and it really goes back to the heart of the original plan. I was involved in the legislature with then-Governor Tommy Thompson at the time when we created school choice and offered it in its large sense in Milwaukee. And the idea was back then is Milwaukee had failing schools, unfortunately a significant number of schools that were failing to meet expectations for the students and their families. And so we said as much as we want to improve them as they continue to fail, wealthy families have an option. They can choose because they have the means to send their son or daughter to a non-public school, to a private school, and offer a better alternative. But low-income families don't have that option. In my last budget, I expanded not just to low-income families in Milwaukee, but to middle-class families because they fall into the same circumstances. Many, if not all those in the middle class, don't have the means by which, particularly with multiple children in the family, to send them to a private school if their son or daughter is going to failing school. What we've applied in this budget beyond Milwaukee and Racine is a similar standard. We now have, through the work we did over the last 2 years, a state report card for every one of our schools.
I see.
And so what we've said, in school districts where they have failing schools, particularly larger school districts, we're going to provide an alternative for those families. Now, we're not ignoring the public schools. We put additional money for performance in there to reward exceptional schools. The A and B schools will get performance incentives that they'll re-earn every year. And failing schools will get a one-time amount that they can apply for only if they show that they're fundamentally turning things around, because I'm not going to pay more money for the same failed progress in the past. But because that's not enough, we can't wait forever for these schools to fix things if they're failing. We're offering parents, families in those schools, in those districts, the option to send their son or daughter to private school. So it's really based on not just saying statewide, it's based on performance. If you live in a school district, if you're in a community, a large community where your schools are all meeting or exceeding expectations, there's no need to expand school choice under our plan because it's meeting our objective. My goal, people mistake sometimes critics of the choice program say, oh, well, you're just trying to get rid of public schools. My kids both went to Wauwatosa public schools. I went to public schools. My nieces go to public schools. I got nothing against them. I love public schools that succeed. I love good quality education. And to me, I'll take it in my public schools because that's where most of my kids are, but I'll take it in choice schools and charter schools and virtual schools and in some cases homeschool environments because I want every kid in my state to succeed regardless of zip code, regardless of income.
The politics of vouchers. Could you have done this expansion to 9 new districts before taking on the teachers' unions?
No.
You could not.
No, I suppose theoretically I could, but what we did is we built the foundation.
Right.
What we did with our reforms empowers our school districts, the public school districts across the state, to make those changes, to balance their budgets, but more importantly, to put people in based on merit, to pay them based on performance. We've given them the tools to succeed, and now it's up to them to say whether or not they got to do it.
You've got the programs already in Milwaukee and West Racine. Name Madison. Madison's a special case because it's the state capital. Name one of the others.
Green Bay.
Green Bay. So is the school board in Green Bay coming to you saying, give us a voucher school.
No.
They are not.
No, you've got the educational establishment is very much circling
and
the wagons.
Even at the local level, the educational establishment still controls things.
Absolutely. And what they're frightened is that they say, well, it's unfair. Green Bay is a good example. They say, well, unfair. We've got great schools. Why are you targeting us? And I say, you do. In fact, in my budget address the other day, I mentioned one of those schools, Keller Elementary. More than 70% of the kids in that school are economically disadvantaged, and yet they're a school on a report card that actually exceeds expectations. They're one of those top performers. Under our plan, they'll get a performance incentive that they can use in turn as a bonus to the great teachers that work at that school. But by the same token, they have a whole series of other schools within that same district in the same community who are failing to meet expectations. And for those parents, just because there's a couple great schools here doesn't mean we shouldn't provide a viable alternative to those schools.
But that's you. That is the governor going into a district and saying, I won't permit this.
Absolutely.
Those parents deserve
I said, in the end, I got to look out for the kids. Everybody talks about it's all about the kids. In our case, we're making it about the children. We're saying every kid deserves access to a great education.
All right. Segment four, Washington versus Madison. Here in Washington, Republicans hold a minority in the Senate and a majority in the House that often seems very much on the defensive. And why wouldn't they seem on the defensive? They got the President of the United States and the press against them. Out in the heartland, you already mentioned this, the Republican Party occupies the governor's mansions in 30 out of the 50 states and controls both houses of legislatures in 27 states. And as I read up on you and Sam Brown back in Kansas, you're doing just fine. You don't seem to be on the defensive. Your morale is high. If the governors, the Republican governors, are taking, broadly speaking, conservative principles and applying them to the practical political problems they face. So the question is this. Is there some way for the governors in the heartland to play a larger role in shaping national perceptions of the GOP? Just how does a governor find a national voice?
Well, I think collectively. I think we just talked about this. Some of the Republican governors got together just yesterday here as part of the overall National Governors Association meeting. And it's one of the points I raised to them and some of the other governors was we need to take a leadership role. We need to take on tough issues and show that they work, not just work in our states, that they work under Republican leadership, Republican ideals work. Because think about the contrast. Unfortunately, and you mentioned some of it's the nature of two-on-one.
Right.
They're on their heels. But some of it's even just the tone. I mean, all too many of our leaders, or at least leading voices amongst Republicans in the nation's capital, seem to be pessimistic. They seem to be irrelevant in how they talk about things. And they tend to a lot of voters, fail to have the courage to act on their principles. In contrast, what we try to offer and what I've said we need to be more aggressive in offering is an optimistic alternative. We need to be realistic about our challenges, no doubt about it. But nobody wants to file, you know, somebody who's sucking lemons all day because they're upset about their state or their nation's economic and financial situation. We need to say, you know, we're Americans, we can do better, and here's the plan, and here's how we move forward. We need to be relevant. Instead of just talking about fiscal cliffs and sequesters, we need to talk about things that people talk about. And as governors, we do that all the time. Because
education, for example.
People come, right, they come to us and say, you know, my kid's school's not living up to my expectations. What are we going to do about it? I got a son or a daughter who's about to graduate from college. Are they going to be able to find a job in the private sector that allows them to stay in the state that they love? My neighbor down the block's out of work. What's going to happen to get the economy improving again so they can get back to work? Those are the things we need to be talking about, and then we need to show we've got the courage to act on them. Sadly, I think too many people look at any leaders, Democrat, Republican, alike in Washington, think they're all talk, there's no action, they don't have the courage to act.
Mitch Daniels, who I'm sure is a friend of yours, but when Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana, used to say that one of the great things about governor was that he had a doing job.
Yeah.
The legislators, the finest legislators, your friend Paul Ryan, he's still a legislator, it's a talking job. Governors get to do stuff. Governor, segment five, how to save the GOP. Let me try a few quotations on you from an article that appeared in Commentary recently called How to Save the Republican Party, in which the authors Mike Gerson and Pete Wehner put forward their agenda. I'd like to see how it sits with the governor from the heartland. Quote, it is no wonder that Republican policies can seem stale. They are very nearly identical to those offered up by the party more than three decades ago. For Republicans to design an agenda that applies to the conditions of 1980 is as if Ronald Reagan designed his agenda for conditions that existed in the Truman years. Governor Walker, the national GOP, just plain stale.
I, I disagree and agree at the same time. That's not a political answer, but let me explain why. I disagree that the principles and the principles upon which our party was founded and upon which we've stood for generations is somehow inconsistent with where voters and the electorate are state by state and across America. Where I agree, though, is the tone is one that needs to be more up to date. It's when I talk about not just being optimistic but relevant, I think that's one of our big challenges. And that's where, I guess, to that extent, I'd agree that the tone's got to be different. I mean, think about it. After the elections, we were told Republicans have to change their positions to attract more young people, to attract immigrants, to attract working families, blue-collar families out there. And I said, it's not that our core principles are wrong, that somehow we have to come up with this new gimmick of new ideas that defy the principles upon which many of us have come into office based on. It's how we explain them. We've got to explain them in more relevant ways to where people are at. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
I mentioned the other day, I introduced a veteran who just come back from serving nearly a year in Afghanistan, Sergeant Luis Cortez Avila, who while he was deployed in Afghanistan last November, took the oath as a United States citizen. He told me when I called and congratulated him and welcomed him home, he told me about how his parents, when he was a baby, had come from Mexico to California. When he was 11, they moved to Wisconsin. He talked about how their dream was that their sons, his brothers and him, would have the chance to be American citizens someday, that they could live the American dream of more freedom and more prosperity. I look at someone like that. I look at immigrants coming in like that. I look at people like that and say, we've got a message that should resonate. Get beyond the national immigration debate. You think about risk takers, people, whether it's coming from Mexico or my ancestors coming from Ireland or Germany or my wife's from Italy, what do they all have in common? They all came with the risk and the hope of saying they were willing to cross, in some cases, oceans, in other cases, great divides to come to this country because they wanted not only for themselves but for future generations the prosperity and freedom that comes from being an American citizen. We need to say we're the party, we're the movement that can make that happen. The other party, once you're indebted to the government, nobody dreams of someday growing up in the United States and being dependent on the government. They dream of being free.
Immigration. Wehner and Gerson again. A new Republican agenda requires the party to welcome rising immigrant groups. You've just been eloquent on that point. The GOP has taken an issue of genuine concern, namely the lack of border security, and spoken about it in ways offensive to vast numbers of Hispanics and Asian Americans, close quote. All right. You, as I said, you've already been just eloquent on welcoming immigrants to this country. But there is what they call that genuine concern, the lack of national border security, where I believe, I'll put it to you, you may disagree if you'd like, but Ronald Reagan signs in what is widely reviewed as an amnesty, but there was a second piece to that amnesty, which was immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. And so for some three decades now, the federal government has failed, utterly failed, to enforce the law at the border. And plenty of people, many of them rank-and-file Republicans, who are more than willing to welcome immigrants, nevertheless say somehow or other that three decades of failure to keep faith with the law and the American people has to be addressed. How does the GOP talk about that?
Could not agree with you more. It is one of the, I mentioned this the other day here in Washington, it is one of the classic examples. I go back to a second when I talk about the Medicaid expansion. People say, you know, why don't you trust the federal government?
Because
they screwed things up. This is a classic example. There couldn't be a larger fundamental fail. A country that is built on immigrants, I mean, my goodness, that's what the Statue of Liberty sits out in front of New York for. It's welcoming people, and it's welcoming people who want to live that dream of freedom and prosperity. But we've got a system, not just in border security, a system overall that is so fundamentally screwed up. We not only have a problem just overall with immigrants, we have a fundamental problem with companies like Microsoft and others, some of our high-tech companies.
Can't get the talent
they can't get enough talent here. We can't even get people who come to our country to get graduate degrees in key areas where we need employees to be plugged in to get a legitimate path to not just to citizenship, but to on a timely basis. This is a fundamental flaw of the federal government. It's not just about border security. It's about the overall system of the federal government has got to fix immigration because we're a country of immigrants, but we're also a country of laws, and we need to respect both. And if we do, if we can force that, that will fix the many problems that we face regarding the immigration.
So the way to talk about the immigration mess, the true way and the compassionate way, but true, is to say, don't blame immigrants. We welcome immigrants. Mm-hmm. blame Washington for yet another federal...
Absolutely. I mean, a good example of this, I mentioned the soldier I mentioned the other day. I mentioned my family. My brother's wife, her mother and grandmother both came from Mexico a generation ago, and they came legally. For immigrants like that or anyone else who comes from anywhere else around the world, they're offended with the idea that they don't want others to come in illegally, but they also realize that there are people hungry for freedom. There are people hungry for opportunity, and the system is so screwed up now, sadly, the way it's situated, it almost forces people to go on those other paths. We need a system that is not broken but is fixed so that people who want to work here, who want to live the American dream, who want to better themselves, their families, and in turn our country, can find a spot to be.
Just another couple of questions, and then I'll let you go back to being a governor. Stop talking and start doing again. Social issues. Once again, Mike Gerson and Pete Wehner. Republicans oppose same-sex marriage out of deference to traditional family structures, but among the largest portion of a rising generation, this appears to be a losing battle, close quote. You yourself, your record is clear. You're opposed to same-sex marriage. You are firmly pro-life. Mm-hmm. But the argument is that the GOP is just on the wrong side of polling and demographics on these issues.
You know, again, it's one of those where comments like that come out of a city like this, which is full of consultants and pollsters. The reality is...
Now you're getting vicious, Governor.
Well, but it's a reality. You look at me and many other Republican governors who are both economically and socially conservative. Why are we in the positions we're at? Why are we succeeding in the positions we're at? Because we stay focused like a laser beam on the reasons we were elected in the first place, to tackle the economic and fiscal challenges of our state. In turn, if we have leaders in Washington or those running for national office, focused like a laser beam on the issues that are relevant to people's lives, whether you agree or disagree with some of these other issues on the side, doesn't overpower the debate. It's when people feel like our leaders are not focused on the things that are relevant to life, about the economy, about fixing the budget, about making their schools better. That's when the debate gets distracted off to some of these other issues where there are legitimate differences of opinion, but far fewer people in my state in the recall election came and asked me about those issues. What they ask about is, what are you going to do to continue to stand up and fight for the taxpayers? How are you going to continue to make sure the taxpayers in charge instead of the big government special interest groups? What are you going to do to continue to balance the budget and create a budget surplus so you can put that money back in the hands of the people of our state and our entrepreneurs? Those are the things people care about. As long as we stay focused on those, we're going to continue to prevail.
Governor, final question. Can you condense into one or two sentences what the rest of the Republican Party ought to be able to learn from your experience in Wisconsin?
Well, it goes back to those same points. Have an optimistic plan, speak about it in terms that are relevant to where people are at, and show you've got the courage to act on it, and then do just that.
Scott Walker, 45th Governor of the great state of Wisconsin, thank you.
Good to be with you.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.